When World War II ended in 1945, Europe and Asia had suffered enormous human and material losses, while the defeated aggressor states of Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan incurred losses far smaller than those that they had inflicted on some of the nations and peoples who were their main target. Nazi Germany, including Austria, not only murdered 6 million Jews, it also summarily executed, starved, gassed, and mistreated an estimated 3.3 million surrendered Red Army combatants. The Wehrmacht caused other millions of Soviet prisoners to die in captivity in Germany by reducing their food rations, not rendering medical care, and depriving them of adequate winter clothing. The estimates range from 1.9 to 3.6 million. Polish, Yugoslav, and Greek combatant and non-combatant deaths were also enormous. Although approximately 236,000 American and British prisoners died in German captivity, the Germans clearly treated American and British prisoners far better than they did Soviet communist and partisan forces. By comparison to the sheer size of these European Allied losses and the demonic nature of German atrocities, the crimes perpetrated by Japanese occupation forces in Asia and the Pacific seem overshadowed. Yet if we take just the figure of over 10 million Chinese deaths and 1 million Filipino deaths seriously, they fully merit attention. Certainly less is known about them because Japanese authorities destroyed most of the documents pertaining to prisoners. But the Japanese army had established a reputation for cruelty in China, where POW status was explicitly denied and rape was allowed to become commonplace. Japan's six-month sweep through colonial Southeast Asia and the Pacific only reinforced that reputation. In the Philippines alone, Japanese forces captured about 25,000 U.S. servicemen. As other Western colonies fell, some 21 to 22,000 Australians, 18,000 Dutch, and 17,000 Canadian combatants lost their freedom. Large numbers of Allied non-combatant civilians, whites and Eurasians, women and children, also fell into Japanese hands. Rough estimates range from 130,000 to over 140,000. The experiences of these interned civilians varied, but about 15,000 of them died, mostly on Java and Sumatra. In the 1942 death march out of Bataan, where Japanese planning for moving, housing, and feeding prisoners was deficient, and in the building of the Burma-Thai Railway, in which an estimated 12,000 combatant Allied prisoners and perhaps 90,000 Burmese, Thai, Malayan, Chinese, Tamils, and Javanese civilian laborers died, wanton acts of extreme brutality and neglect by Japanese soldiers occurred. Over time, Japanese military behavior worsened, as did conditions in their jungle camps and on the so-called hell ships in which prisoners were moved around the Pacific. By war's end, Japan held in captivity an estimated 193,000 Allied servicemen, of which over 36,000 were Americans. I had to lay out these statistics so we'll know the scale of the problem that I'm addressing. Having made the punishment of war criminals, Axis war criminals, a major aim, with the end of hostilities, the Allies, working with the International Red Cross, set about rethinking, reinforcing, and extending the laws of warfare as enumerated in the Hague Conventions, 1899-1907, the Geneva Protocol of 1925, outlawing all forms of chemical and biological warfare, and the two 1929 Geneva Conventions on the treatment of prisoners and the wounded and sick on the battlefield. Now, in August 1945, as many of you may know, The representatives of the U.S., Britain, and the Soviet Union and France signed the London Agreement concerning the pursuit and punishment of major Axis war criminals. And appended to this international agreement was a charter drafted with the Holocaust in mind by men who had come to believe in the progressive development of rules of warfare. The charter formulated new categories of crimes against peace, crimes against humanity, and individuals exercising high authority as well as institutions or governments were to be held liable for violations of the laws and customs of warfare, as well as for planning, starting, and waging wars of aggression in violation of international treaties. And 3 months later at Nuremberg, the first precedent-setting trial of a mere 22 Nazi German war criminals got underway. And shortly after it ended, in late 1945, the UN General Assembly unanimously approved the legal and ethical principles sanctioned by the Nuremberg Charter and recognized them as customary international law. The human rights revolution had begun. Nuremberg and Tokyo were its launching sites. I'm going now to talk a bit about the Tokyo trial. Then I'm going to look at the military commission trials. In the course of doing this, I will talk about the legacies from both trials. I'd like you to know at the outset, I consider both endeavors overall to have been very noble endeavors. What I will concentrate in conveying is the ambiguous, complex nature of both of these war tribunals and the consequences that followed from them. The International Military Tribunal for the Far East, or Tokyo Trial, was based largely on the Nuremberg Charter and reflected the liberalism and idealism as well as the realism of the period in which it was conceived. Nuremberg was part of the largely American-crafted New Order anchored in the United Nations and its charter, which the United States Congress approved. And the Senate also, for the first time, joined the UN's International Court of Justice. Momentarily, there welled up in the United States a messianic yearning for a moral world free of war, militarism, and armaments. Some thought the post-war world should be grounded in the rule of international law. Others leaned to world security guaranteed by the military power of the Big Three, the U.S., Britain, and the Soviet Union. But while this end-of-war mood lasted among politically influential elites, the Democratic Party government of Harry Truman was forced to acknowledge it. 60 years later, international society is very different. So too is the United States. Proclaiming itself the sole hegemonic power, it scares the world by its addiction to exercising unilateral force illegally, regardless of the political, moral, or economic costs. Its leaders repudiate the Nuremberg principles, undermine international order and human rights as defined in the Universal Declaration, and of their own free choice wage unprovoked, non-defensive, that is, preventive wars of aggression in defiance of the UN Charter. Not only has the Bush Republican administration reopened the issue of crimes against peace the way the Democratic administrations of Kennedy and Johnson had once done, it has ridiculed international law and openly sanctioned torture. Inadvertently, it has brought to the fore of world concern issues of war crimes, mistreatment of POWs, and war prisons. Today, the U.S. government arbitrarily withholds the protections of the Geneva Conventions and the U.S. Constitution from POWs and civilian detainees whom it labels enemy combatants. And the mainstream intellectual and political elites, the Congress especially, no longer act from a belief in the progressive development of rules of international conduct to restrict war making. By contrast, some of the most politically influential Americans of the generation that fought World War II believed deeply in the rule of law. even though they remained silent when Japanese Americans were placed in detention camps and their own legal system denied justice to minorities of color. Supreme Court Justice Robert Jackson, whom Presidents Roosevelt and Truman appointed to take charge of war crimes policy, emphatically rejected aggressive war making. Jackson viewed international law as an a priori moral good and proudly considered public war crimes trials expeditiously conducted exemplary of American democratic ideals and not just a way of exacting retribution. Of course, he also insisted that the defendants in war crimes trials be denied the advantages of Anglo-American evidentiary and procedural rules. Republican Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson expressed a similar viewpoint. He wanted Nazi war criminals tried, quote, in a dignified manner, consistent with the advance of civilization, unquote. Eleanor Roosevelt, who chaired the UN commission that drew up the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, key parts of which the US today officially rejects, shared these general attitudes. So too did most NGOs and peace organizations. They all sought punishment of the guilty for having violated the established rules of law or the principles that, quote, civilized nations, unquote, considered wrong. They also wanted the German and Japanese people reoriented so that they could open new chapters as peaceful nations. Above all, they wanted formal judicial trials to be conducted fairly and publicly in accordance with a stripped-down version of the Bill of Rights. Jumping ahead, I'd like you to know that it's unfortunate that senior U.S. military and civil officials looking for ways to gain competitive advantage for the United States over its potential rivals were only too willing to compromise principle. So despite the desire of the lawyers of the International Prosecution Section within General MacArthur's headquarters in Tokyo to uphold the rule of law, the Tokyo trial was not consistently conducted and as an example of democratic ideals. Nevertheless, note that in its final judgment, Tokyo, like even more than Nuremberg, laid great stress on the crime against peace, which Jackson had called the supreme international crime, because it differed from the others in that it contained within itself the accumulated evil of the whole. When a nation wages a war of aggression, that crime against peace itself contains the accumulated evil of the whole. This was an idea in advance of legal thought at the time. Well, from an educational point of view, the Tokyo trial achieved much. It established Japan's responsibility for aggression, something that was not obvious to the Japanese people when it began. And at its end, the tribunal punished a token number of war criminals, 25, including former prime ministers and foreign ministers. In the process, it furthered the U.S. occupation goal of demilitarization, and it lent momentum to the incipient Japanese peace movement. So having made a profound many-sided impact on the Japanese nation, the ad hoc trial in Tokyo dissolved, leaving behind a vast archive of materials, which Japanese and foreign writers have continually sifted in an effort to assess war responsibility and discern whether justice was really done. A central goal, U.S. goal, in staging the Tokyo trial had been to demonstrate to the world the higher moral standards of Anglo-Americans, while at the same time, this is the realism at work, or the realists at work, at the same time, taking steps out of public view to assure that the U.S. and its allies were not subjected to prosecution for Hague and Geneva Treaty violations comparable to those for which jail terms and death sentences were meted out to the losers. Japanese defense attorneys and students of the Tokyo trial naturally resented that. They asked, was preservation of the myth of Anglo-American virtue a good reason for the Allies to have focused exclusively on Japan's war criminality while ignoring the issue of their own war crimes? Most Americans have been keenly aware of Japanese atrocities, but largely unaware of or blinded by racism to their own. Public figures like the famed pilot hero Charles Lindbergh had observed much criminal individual behavior by Americans while visiting South Pacific battlefields in 1944. Often Lindbergh was told, quote, "Our boys don't like to take prisoners," unquote. Quote, "We claim to be fighting for civilization, but the more I see of this war in the Pacific," unquote, Lindbergh wrote, quote, "the less right I think we have to claim to be civilized. In fact, I'm not sure that our record in this respect stands so very much higher than the Japs," unquote. Quote, "It was freely admitted that some of our soldiers tortured Japanese prisoners and were as cruel and barbaric at times as the Japanese themselves. Our men think nothing of shooting a prisoner or a soldier attempting to surrender, and these acts are condoned by almost everyone. We hold Japanese examples of atrocity screamingly to the heavens while we cover up our own and condone them as just retribution for his acts." Well, thousands of Japanese soldiers, sailors, and civilians returned home after having witnessed or heard about American soldiers and Marines mutilating the bodies of enemy wounded and dead on the battlefield, committing atrocities of the sort that Lindbergh described as routine. They too must have wondered why only the Japanese were called war criminals. Where was the justice, let alone the morality, in that? At the time of the Tokyo trial, many Japanese also retained their older feelings of ambiguity about international law. They had just fought and lost a war purportedly to rid Asia of structures and values that the Western powers had fostered in accordance with their famous, quote, "standard of civilization," unquote. Now they were to be judged by laws they knew to be inextricably connected with imperialism and the standard of civilization. Japanese observers of the Tokyo trial raised other pertinent questions. Was it right to have placed all responsibility for the outbreak of war in 41 on Japan when its Western opponents were imperialist states holding Asian peoples in colonial subjugation? Why didn't they address the strafing of Japanese civilians with machine gun fire on the main islands, or the large-scale rape of Japanese women by American soldiers on Okinawa after the battle there? Above all, why did the War Crimes Court rule as out of bounds President Truman's decision to unleash atomic bombs on the two purposely spared cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in which hundreds of thousands more civilians died? Wasn't that a crime against humanity? And why did the American rulers conduct propaganda on a vast scale to try to convince the U.S. public that it was actually the bombs which ended the war, rather than the Soviet entry into the war? On these issues, the silence of the American prosecutor Joseph B. Keenan and the rulings of the Australian Tribunal President William Webb angered the Indian justice on the tribunal. My point here is simply that if many Japanese people have been conflicted about the nature of their lost war, it is understandable. For the Pacific War was both a conflict among imperialist powers over control of resources and territory and an ideological war. But the Japan-China War and the Japanese occupation of Southeast Asia was of a different nature. And if Japanese writers especially have found compelling reasons for questioning the Tokyo trial's credibility, who can blame them either? Both sides committed atrocities, yet only the vanquished would judge. Inevitably, that happens when the victors judge the vanquished. Now, a more important point, if I can put it that way. The Tokyo trial was indeed a type of victor's justice, and it deployed flawed procedures. But what Japanese writers do not understand was that Tokyo was by no means the worst type of victor's justice. Like their counterparts at Nuremberg, the men who organized and conducted it were on the right track, engaged in a noble endeavor to criminalize aggression and create a legal framework for prosecuting future war crimes, even if they could not forestall them. Moreover, the prosecutors and judges succeeded in helping the Japanese people to confront the human consequences of their aggression. So, in the end, Tokyo had a complex, multi-sided nature in which many positive and negative aspects intermingled. Now, let me say a word about where the world went after Tokyo, from Nuremberg and Tokyo. And many journalists in recent years have pointed this out. You can trace a straight line to the strengthening of the Geneva Conventions in 1949, those four Geneva Conventions, to give more protection to the victims of war. And thereafter, belief in the legal principles applied at Nuremberg and Tokyo quickly waned. We all know that. The Cold War set in. When President Truman illegally committed the United States to war in Korea on his own authority, without congressional approval or prior authorization from the UN Security Council, he struck a major blow at the new international legal framework. He also put the United States into a permanent state of war, the state of war that exists today. Three war-filled decades later, the ending of the Cold War crusade against communism gave birth to a new global movement for justice. During the 1990s, interest in Nuremberg principles revived. Actually, I find evidence of its revival from the start of the Reagan administration. The real revival came in the 90s, and it found institutional expression in the UN ad hoc trials for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda. The establishment of the International Criminal Court in 2002 marked another high point in the development of international law. But liberal intellectual infatuation with humanitarian interventions, which meant so-called pro-democratic invasions, started under President Reagan, and they paved the way for the extreme realism to rear its ugly head under the second Bush. Well, it might seem ironic from everything I've said so far that the U.S., which did so much to construct the post-1945 international order, has trampled openly on the Geneva Conventions and sought to destroy the ICC in order to exclude U.S. troops and high government officials from criminal accountability under international law. But take a closer look at the international law record, and you'll see that all along the U.S. and Britain had ensured that the 1949 Geneva Conventions on the protection of POWs and civilians did not protect civilians from air attack. The Truman administration, imagining future wars, wanted civilians stripped of protection from atomic bombs and the U.S. Air Force left free to target economic infrastructure. And the British government, engaged since 1947 in large-scale bombing operations in its Persian Gulf protectorate of Aden, present-day Yemen, also wanted all aerial bombing operations to remain unrestrained by international law. Even the word war crimes it wanted deleted from the conventions. The Swedish historian Sven Lindqvist remarked, quote, "The victorious powers could hardly forbid bombing of civilians without incriminating themselves for what they'd already done and planned to do," unquote, in the Third World. And I would add, remember, it was in the Third World that the Cold War was fought out. So you see that these facts suggest a more than academic interest in reviewing the Tokyo trial's negative features. Let me just mention in passing a few of those negative features. But it occurs to me that I should preface what I'm going to say, that Bush's secret military commissions, precipitated a controversy starting in November 2001. And you will remember that's when he set up military commissions at the Guantanamo Bay military base in still U.S.-occupied part of Cuba to try captured Taliban. So that's a factor in the background as I proceed here. Well, one negative feature of the Tokyo trial is that the U.S. took steps in September of 1945 to ensure that the Pentagon, rather than the State Department, would control the proceedings. And that's how it was. Pentagon, not the State Department. The sentiment in Washington was that, unlike in Europe, the U.S. had borne the main burden of defeating Japan, so it should control the trial of the war criminals and grant the Allies a free hand only within their former colonies. How do you manage that? You manage it by making the charter for the Tokyo trial astonishingly vague. Its unique vagueness was itself an early expression of an American impulse to unilateralism. A second negative feature, the realists on the State War Navy Coordinating Committee in Washington at war's end temporarily exempted Emperor Hirohito from indictment. And that decision made it impossible for the prosecutors and judges to understand how the Imperial Japanese government functioned. Another non-technical way of saying this is leaving out Hirohito distorted the problem statement associated with the Tokyo trial and therefore set limits to what the trial could offer. A more appropriate statement might have been, we must go to the highest level of state authority and find out who was ultimately responsible for the war and these atrocities. Precisely this is what the realists wanted to avoid. We want to say a word about the legacies of the Tokyo trial.